Over the next three episodes, I'll temporarily relinquish my interview seat in favour of Robin Wigglesworth, global finance correspondent at the Financial Times. As the author of the best-selling book Trillions, about passive investing, he's well-placed to explore the topic of quant investing with the help of three of the biggest names in the industry. So without further ado, please enjoy Robin and this mini-series. Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
Hi, my name is Robin Wigglesworth. I'm a journalist with the Financial Times, but I'm glad to say that Simon has relinquished his normal seat for a few episodes to allow me to dig into one of my favourite subjects, quantitative investing, and how it's reshaping asset management and markets more broadly. I'd like to welcome my guest, Leda Braga, the founder and chief executive of Systematica.
Hi, Robin. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to contribute.
Leda, as the name indicates, Systematica is a quantitative investment manager, and you run one of the biggest and best regarded trend following funds in the business. I know that Systematica was initially spun out of Michael Platt's Bluecrest, and earlier this year, you completed what seemed to be, from the outside at least, to be a remarkably amicable divorce when you and Systematica investor AMG acquired the last slice of Platt's stake in the business. So I've seen some people call you the queen of quants, so I'm pretty thrilled to have you here to explore the wonderful and fascinating world of systematic investing and trading. But first of all, your background. How do you go from Rio de Janeiro to a PhD in engineering from Imperial to running a hedge fund?
It's been a long journey. I first came to the UK in 1988. As you know, I'm an engineer by training. And so I guess the question is, how does an engineer get involved in finance? Engineers are people that seek problems to address. So intellectual curiosity in engineers very much goes with applications. And so in the late 80s, early 90s in London, the financial industry was really taking off. That was the numerical technical problem around. So it was, as with many things in life, a bit what I call the Monte Carlo of life. I was in London. I did do a PhD at Imperial. I was very lucky to be offered a lectureship at Imperial. So I stayed a few years there and did research and it was great. But I sort of craved that commercial pressure. And if you wanted more commercial pressure beyond academia, then around me, there was London and the derivatives world was really exploding. And so the opportunities were there. And then from there, it was JP Morgan for a long time. And then I made lots of contacts. Then many years into JP Morgan, I moved to a startup that JP Morgan launched, failed miserably. And then Bluecrest had then just started. And I knew Mike Platt and Bill Reeves from the Morgan days. And so there was an idea, oh, look, why don't you come and join us? And then maybe you can do a few things that we need. And on the side, you might look at a few things, for example, systematic trading. And that's how it all began, really.
So what would you have done if you hadn't gone into finance? Would you have been an engineer, you think? Engineering professor, maybe?
Yeah, very much so. Academia was great. No complaints there. Engineering is a fantastic career. I'm pleased to say my son is studying engineering. And I swear, I did not try to influence him. Everything that you see around you and technology progress, engineers, they get on and crack the problems, the technology that we use, the phones, the airplanes. Engineering, where I come from, is a very respected career choice. It would take me aback in the early years in the UK how broadly the term engineer is used. And sometimes somebody that where I grew up would be referred to as a technician. So a technician is somebody who learns a particular bit, like to fix your fridge or to deal with an installation. Whereas an engineer is a big word where I come from. An engineer is a design, a very broad technical skill. But it was a very prestigious career choice as well where I come from.
I can imagine. And my parents are both architects. So obviously engineers for them are sometimes colleagues and sometimes frenemies, I guess, as well.
Yeah, that's right.
But are there any particular fields of engineering that you found the most fascinating?
I'm a mechanical engineer by training. And so there was always an interest in cars and engines and airplanes. And these are very specialized industries, and you've got to be in the right location to get a job. You may know Brazil does have a presence in aeronautical engineering, right? So they do make aircraft that are quite successful globally. That would be my choice. And in my PhD, I studied fracture mechanics, which is an application, the study of a particular type of failure. It's quite interesting. It applies to aero. It applies to pressure vessel problems and to pipelines and transmission lines. And it's a fantastic problem. It was a very exciting time to be in it. So that would have been where I would have gone. I would probably have tried my luck at being a specialist in fracture mechanics. That would have been the alternative.
We're obviously going to dive into the problem-solving aspects of quant trading. But I heard that when you first joined Bluecrest, you were actually pregnant. What was that like at the time? And has the industry gotten better at being a little bit more welcoming for people of both genders and different cycles of life as well?
Yes, I think it has. I think it's in everybody's mind nowadays, particularly gender equality, which is so blatant, so staring you in the face. But when people ask me, what kind of prejudice did you encounter? What kind of problem? I cannot say that I felt that there was a barrier. I cannot say that. Now, some of my friends tell me later the barriers were there. The problem is you were not in the mood to see them. But maybe that is a good attitude, right? If you just go about your business and you sink your teeth into stuff, and if people get in your way, you jump that obstacle. And so I can't say that I ever felt the prejudice or the barriers. The fact that I was pregnant when I started at Bluecrest, I think looking back, is a good example of that, because I was very heavily pregnant. I was pregnant late. I was 35 already. And my son is 20, I'm 55 now. I was determined to sort of carry on with my career and my work with the full commitment. And I was just determined. I said, look, there is no such thing as the right time to get pregnant. Anyway, I am pregnant. This is going to be sorted out somehow. And so the first thing that I did, I was actually pregnant when I was in this startup that JP Morgan launched, which was a very, very demanding job. You want to do a startup, brace yourself, because there's no such thing as going home time. And also because we had financial difficulties in that startup, I went a long time, years without even talking about a bonus, but no base salary, no nothing. And it was a bit of a financial disaster in the end. So the first thing that happened was I was pregnant and I was doing the startup, which you'd kind of think, gosh, you know, maybe you shouldn't have done that. You should have taken the more conservative approach. But I thought, no, I'm going to take decoupled decisions here. I'm pregnant and I am getting on with my career. And so then when the whole thing fell apart and we actually filed for Chapter 11, which was born in November, so this was September, so I was probably about 30 weeks pregnant, so quite late in my pregnancy. Mike Platt and Bill Reeves, they knew that we were winding down that startup that JP Morgan launched. And so they called me and they said, oh, you should come and talk to us. And I was a bit hesitant, envisaged going back to the type of job that I had had in the bank before. But then there was the startup bug in me. Once you try the freedom and the buzz and the initiative that goes with the startup, you don't want to let it go. And so I turned up for lunch with them, and I'm so heavily pregnant that it didn't occur to me to say anything because it's really obvious. But it wasn't clear that they even noticed. And there were conversations later because they kind of knew me. And so they were probably concentrating on my face. And if we're sitting at a lunch table and I had a jacket, maybe they did not. I agreed to get started in Blue Crest. It was an afterthought. I wrote to them and I said, I'm going to need a few weeks off when the baby comes. And that is what I did. And so I went and had the baby. I had a cesarean. So I stayed in hostel maybe 5 days. And then at the Monday after, I started taking calls at work because I wanted to. There was a lot of interesting work going on. So I started doing a call a day to catch up. And then within a few weeks, I was back at work. So one of the things that I say to women that ask me is, if you like to work, try to do what you like. If you want to stay at home and look after the kid, then that's what you do. But if you like your work, which I really did, then try to do it and don't feel guilty. I often say to them, think about it. Your kid could have been born to an uneducated, temperamental person somewhere. It's been born to you. It's already winning. So don't feel guilty. Get on with your life. And I have a great relationship with my son, I should think. And so just don't feel guilty. Get on with it. That's what I say. And I'm not a good example of somebody who identifies the barriers and what to do about them because I steamrolled over them. I wasn't really attuned to that very much.
There's so many people that always feel guilted about everything. And sadly, I see men don't feel the same guilt always. It does seem to be piled on women a little bit more. But yeah, your son is following in your footsteps. So that seems to work out pretty well.
It's interesting to see. He's a very independent guy and studies very hard and does what he does. But occasionally he will call me for advice. And it sounds like a colleague asking me for advice. And that's kind of cool. If you think about being of use to your child will be a baby for a couple of years, will be a child for about 10 years, and then he's an adult. And are you more useful to your child if you stop everything that you do and you become just a parent, perhaps of less use to your child?
Probably a good thing for kids to see that their parents have outside interests, work, and that's a bit of an example as well. When you moved to Switzerland with Blue Crest, that's when you started Blue Trend, the trend following fund that still remains at the heart of Systematica. Tell me a little bit about the genesis story of Blue Trend.
As I said to you, Blue Crest was very early days when I joined. They started the company Bill and Mike December 2000, and I joined in 2001. The idea was I had a day job and I was going to do the sort of job that I was doing at JP Morgan, which was aiding them with models for analysis because they were the traders. But then on the side, I was going to look into a couple of startup type of initiatives, and one of them was systematic trading. Didn't know anything about systematic trading. I remember saying to them at the time, if you really want to do systematic trading, why don't you guys hire somebody who's done it before? And they said, because you've gone through a startup failure later, and that is priceless. They were probably right, because once you've been part of a business that has failed, that is a very powerful lesson. So I was trying several things. We tried some equity strategies. We tried some foreign exchange strategies. And then we sort of stumbled upon trend following. And that would have been about 2002, actually. And so by 2003, we had the sketch of what would become the Blue Trend Fund. So we had a basic trend following model on futures. We launched that as one sub-strategy of the big main fund that Blue Crest had, which was called Blue Crest Capital International. So Capital International allocated some money to our trend following strategy. And it grew from there. We realized we can actually do a pretty good job at this. We kept looking at the competition in terms of trend followers and realized that we were doing just as well, if not a little bit better than perhaps the average person out there. But it was interesting because there was a bit of a combined background there. We weren't just people that had done this before. We were people that had come from being quants in a bank with that background of derivatives pricing, which is a different branch of the quant world, the people that price contingent claims, options and derivatives and credit products. And then we were branching into this area of trend following, which was really investment management. And perhaps for that reason, we sort of did things a little bit different every now and then in the model, and that resulted in good performance for us. So then by 2003, we were trading a sizable amount of money on behalf of Blue Crest Capital International. I'm going to say $350 million. And so then we thought of launching a separate fund. And so in 2004, we then launched the Blue Trend Fund, and then people started investing in that separately. And then, of course, trend following was not particularly fashionable then, but it did very, very well in the financial crisis. And so it captured everybody's attention. And it's true. That's the interesting thing about trend following. It's low correlation with traditional asset classes, which you kind of expect from hedge funds, right? Paying hedge fund fees, I want low correlation. But this low correlation of trend following is delivered in a really desirable way because it's delivered with bursts of negative correlation at times of market stress. So the thing is sitting there and it's decorrelated. And then when the rubbish hits the fan, the thing delivers a lot of return. So it's a very desirable property.
And that was especially after the financial crisis. That really was the big shining moment for trend following funds.
That's right.
Your point about how you guys were quants from a bank perspective, so you maybe did things a little bit differently. I'd love to hear a little bit more about how Systematica does do things differently from other quantitative trading firms out there, and specifically other trend following firms. Because obviously this is a pretty broad field, right?
Yeah. It's difficult to spot exactly what other people do. I can tell you a few broad things where I know we are perhaps different. We have a very cooperative research team. One of the things you see in the quant world is some shops specifically silo their researchers to protect the intellectual property. So they'll say, look, you work on this, but you don't work on that. And often they will tell their clients, no single person or no single team has the knowledge or the sight of the whole process. So I have access to what my colleagues are doing, because apart from anything, creating ideas and innovation out of the ether is just not possible. You need to see what people are doing. And so that is one differentiation aspect, the fact that we are cooperative in our research setup. I think we are very non-hierarchical as well. We all sit together on the floor. I often say, look, you certainly can't offend me. You can't offend the senior crowd. So if you say, you're an idiot for doing this, what you're going to get from me is, why? Can you tell me why? You're not going to get any anger back. We try to take questions. And there are downsides to that. So for example, recently, we had a leadership coach come and have a dialogue with several people in our firm in the context of training and leadership training, etc. And he did point that out. He says, look, the fact that you're so flat in terms of hierarchy is good, but it's also bad because people like the reinforcement of knowing they've got a title and a promotion. And so it's not all perfect. We're very cooperative. We're very open. We're very non-hierarchical. And we're quite diversified in what we do. So we have a good track record in trend following, but we do a lot more than that. We have equity programs. We have derivatives, relative value programs. We're big traders in options, foreign exchange options, equity options. When we talk to our colleagues about, oh, should we specialize? Should we just do that? The reaction is invariably, please, no. Let us do a bit of everything. Let's keep it varied and let's keep it interesting. So these are some of the things that probably make us a bit different, I suppose.
Well, I can see the downsides of sort of lack of hierarchy because people do love it, generally speaking. But I remember speaking to Google's Eric Schmidt about this because he was a big investor in D.E. Shaw. And after David Shaw retired, that's also run by a committee. And also is pretty flat in structure. And it was kind of interesting that if it works well, then it works really well, essentially.
Yeah, for people that are predominantly intellectually driven, rational people, the idea that you have no hierarchy and you just favor the debate is very powerful. The world has a phrase now that's called data-driven decision-making. When I first heard that, I used to say to myself, gosh, is there any other type? I myself said, later, how stupid can you be, woman? Of course there is. Most decisions are made based on emotions. They're not based on data-driven analysis. But I guess even if we are all emotional beings, we quants, mathematicians, engineers, are to the right side of the rationality spectrum, right? So we tend to be a bit more rational than average, I would imagine. So the flat hierarchy and the decision by debate and decision by somewhat consensus is still appeals.
Can you just tell me quickly what does a systematic trend follower do? What is that strategy?
In systematic strategies, in fact, in any investment strategy, there are two basic top-level steps that you need to take. One is signal generation, and the other one is position sizing. Signal generation means, what am I going to buy? What am I going to sell? What do I like? What don't I like? That's signal generation. Position sizing means, I mean, even if you absolutely knew what the stock market is going to do tomorrow, you'd still have to decide how much of it to buy. So position sizing is an extra step that you need to take. And so trend following refers to the signal generation part. It means that you're extracting your signal from the hypothesis of the trend. So I'm going to decide which securities I like and don't like. So which ones I'll buy, which ones I'll sell, based on the hypothesis of the trend. And what is the hypothesis of the trend? Well, it is that it's a price-based analysis. So I'm not looking at the news. I'm not looking at financial statements for companies. I'm looking simply at the time series of prices. I'll look at the time series of prices and I'll try to establish whether in the dynamic of that time series of prices, if a trend is forming. And the assumption is then that if there is a trend, it will continue a little further. So securities that are on a trend up, I'm going to assume that they're going to go up a little bit higher. So I'm going to buy those. And securities that are on a trend down, I'll assume they'll go a little bit lower. And so I'm going to sell those. And that's basically the hypothesis of the trend. And so how do we do that? First comment is, as far as signals go, this is a directional signal. It's a signal that is attempting to say, tomorrow or next week, this security is going to go up or it's going to go down. And that's very difficult. It's much easier to have relative value opinions on things, to say, oh, BMW is going to do better than VW because BMW sales are a bit better. But whether BMW is going to go up or down tomorrow, that is a very difficult thing to say. So the first thing to say is a directional signal. It's a very weak signal, and you need to deploy it over a variety of time horizons. So short-term trend, medium-term trend, long-term trend. And you need to apply it over a number of securities at the same time to sort of hope to construct a portfolio that will make you money on average over time. That's basically it. You're just trying to look at the price action of securities. You're going to try to determine whether each security is on a trend up or on a trend down or on no trend at all. And that is your signal. And then equipped with your signal across a large number of securities, I will then construct a portfolio. So in other words, I will size my positions, taking into account that some of these securities will be riskier than others, will deliver more volatility than others. So I'll probably have smaller positions in the ones that are riskier and bigger positions in the ones that are less risky.
Speaking of the short, medium-term and long-term trend following, what are the general pros and cons of that? And where in that spectrum does Systematica fit?
If you're doing an investigation on trend following, you pick up the mathematical functions that can measure the trend. So given a time series of prices, what kind of functions do I deploy on those time series of prices to determine if they are on a trend line? Those functions typically have parameters that will say whether they are doing that assessment over a few hours, a few days, a few months, a few years. As a quant, you will sit in front of the market data over the long term and you kind of wonder, what are the time ranges that work? And there's a working range there for the trend following from the very short term, intraday, all the way to about a year. Now, Blue Trend is a medium-term trend follower, industry speak. That means that the signals for detection of the trend, which Blue Trend deploys, are signals that go half-life of between a few days and 3 months. It's a good range for institutional investors because there's good capacity. You can actually execute at size.
On the short end, does that lead into high-frequency trading as well, on the very short-end trend following? Or are they still fairly distinct?
Trend following is a signal that can be used for high frequency trading. And then capacity is a bit more constrained because you're going to trade a lot. Transaction cost starts to play a big part. So it's not trivial to make that work. But yeah, it is a valid signal. We deploy it in the context of execution algorithms. We have the alpha engines that we run, various types, relative value, trend following. And then typically in the machinery that we have, we will have modules for the execution. So in other words, if an alpha engine then says, okay, go and buy me 200 lots, then that desire to buy 200 lots is transferred to the execution side of the machinery.
I get transaction costs and execution is an underappreciated pillar of quant investing, that quants, broadly speaking, whether as they do startup or trend following, spend a lot of time and effort and resources in minimizing their transaction costs. Is that right? Is it more important for quant manager than it is for a big discretionary one?
Perhaps you are right in saying that it's a little more important for the quant manager, because what is the difference between the quant manager and the discretionary manager? The discretionary guy typically has 4 to 10 live ideas at any one time. So remember, I said to you, there's signal generation and portfolio construction. So signal generation and position sizing. And I told you, oh, look, the trend following signal is cool because it's simple to calculate, but it's actually a very weak signal. So if you have a weak signal and if you have 10 positions on, you're doomed because 10 positions can really go wrong. If you have hundreds of positions on, then the average starts to work for you. And even though the signal is weak, it will work. Going back to the original point, the difference between the discretionary guy and the quantitative guy, or one of the differences, is the number of positions in the portfolio. So quantitative traders tend to have more diversified portfolios at lower confidence. So my signal is not so polished and so refined. The discretionary guy tends to have fewer ideas on, but they're really high conviction. He's nannied and babied those ideas to the limit. So he's really confident of those ideas. So as a consequence, the discretionary investment manager perhaps executes less. So he can get away with spending a bit more on execution, whereas we execute quite a bit more because we have so many more positions. And then the other difference is that we measure the stuff like crazy. So sometimes you go up to a discretionary guy, and in the Bluecrest days, half the assets of Bluecrest were managed on a discretionary basis, half the assets were managed on the systematic side. And I had the big title of president of the firm, so I worked on both sides quite a bit. You could walk up to a discretionary trader, how much of your returns do you spend on execution? And many of them don't know. They sort of execute throughout the day, they watch the market, they've got a few trades to do, they're very manual about it. So they don't have to keep track of it quite so strictly.
You've obviously been doing this for a while now, and bearing in mind that obviously quantitative finance and quantitative investing is a very broad church, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how it's evolved over your career.
It's evolved positively for the discipline. There's a lot more interest, a lot more acceptance. There is this thing that is recognized in psychology and in business studies, which they call algorithm aversion. And they say that even when you know that the algorithm will do better than you, you prefer to believe a fellow human being. So it's something that binds us together as a species, I guess. You know, I like to trust somebody. But I think by and large, that has been reducing. I think people accept that quantitative trading has got to be the way forward. Because think about the world we live in. There are pressures on pension funds everywhere in the world. Longevity is only increasing. Life expectancy is increasing. So pension funds and the various capital pools of the world, insurance companies or endowments, they're all under pressure to produce returns. So fees need to come down. So people that run investment management, you guys have to work out how to do it in a scalable way, because that's the only way you're going to make a profit. So if you want to do it in a scalable way, you want to move away from doing it manually. You want to do it with technology. That's one side. Then another side is this regulatory pressure and the reputational sensitivity that so many people have nowadays. So when the process is systematic, the process is fully auditable. You better believe that we're not going to concentrate ourselves on a position because the process is articulated formally. And so there's a level of transparency, there's a level of scalability, a level of modernity about it as well. The fact that it's data science is a very glamorous discipline. So in general, it's been a positive trend for the industry. There is still this challenge that we were talking about, that when I look at a discretionary manager, I kind of think a discretionary manager wants to make money. He makes money for a living. And the systematic manager makes processes that make money in the long term. So the challenge is almost one step higher. I'm not satisfied with making money tomorrow. Our team needs to develop processes that make money on an ongoing basis. That is a challenge. And sometimes these processes take a while to get right. They go through patches where they don't work so well. The financial industry, financial markets have a lot of randomness in their behavior. And no matter how well you do your job, sometimes the randomness just works against you for a long period of time. But I think in general, investors have become more technical, more understanding and more committed to that. But I've been saying for a while, I think the long-term future is the majority of investment management will be performed through a systematic means.
It's a fascinating point, the differentiation between just making money and building a process that makes money over time. Because that is a lot of what I hear from a lot of big discretionary asset managers and even individual portfolio managers. It's all about repeatable processes, whether you do it in a discretionary or systematic way. How do you do that in practice?
So we bother to articulate the rules. If you talk to a discretionary trader, they will tell you how they trade through examples, and they'll tell you, well, the short end of the euro curve has been doing this, and I don't think it's going to go to that level. If you're a systematic trader listening to that, you really try to unpick the parameters. And what are the quantities he's really looking at? Is he looking at the slope of the curve? Is he comparing the euro curve to the dollar curve? Is he looking at the 3 versus 6? What is he really looking at? And then when you decide what he is really looking at, you then think, okay, so this thing is perhaps a combination of securities. He's looking at a spread, 3 versus 6 or 5 versus 10s. What is the volatility of that thing? Because the volatility of that thing is not necessarily the volatility of each one of the components. There is a spread vol to measure. And so then the systematic trader sizes the positions in a very technical way. So the discretionary guy gets away with having it all in his mind and just running that thing on an ongoing basis. The systematic trader needs to articulate the process for sure, needs to be articulated enough that it'll be codable, that you can actually produce code to go with it. And of course, even though there's some pain in articulating the process, once you've done it, you've got a powerful machine because you can deploy it on different securities. You can see how it worked historically. And not only that, you can also feel a bit more empowered by your client to follow that model because you've disclosed it to your client, you've discussed it to your client. So you've got a mandate to go and follow it. Whereas the discretionary guy, he's not allowed to lose money because it's a person. And if he loses money, John, I'm going to take it to one side. What are you doing with my money? We've lost money. So there's all this emotional pressure, which in the quant world, there is that layer of generalization between the investment approach and the fund.
I've always thought of humans as great pattern recognition machines ourselves, but a lot of the patterns we recognize, we call it our gut feeling. But of course, a human discretionary trader or investment manager can spin a great narrative about why they were right. Is that still a stumbling point for quant adoption, that people still want to talk to a human portfolio manager and yell at them when they get something wrong or praise them and think they're geniuses when they get it right?
Completely. Human beings love a story. A story will get you a long way. So many times people ask me questions and say, well, why is this not working? And I would say, well, the answer to your question is, I do not know. I do not know because to tell you that I knew, I would be able to demonstrate it mathematically that I know, and I can't do that. I can hypothesize and I can have a discussion with you about the things I see in that market. But that's a very dry way of telling a story, isn't it? So perhaps we would do ourselves a favor, we quants, if we embrace the story a bit more. Then people say that we are the black box. I say, my gosh, that's so unfair. We are the whitest of boxes. We are the ones that articulate. I always tell clients, look, we'll answer any question you want. Ask me the question. Verbally, we will answer. We will explain it to you. And if you're nervous about a big day in the market, pick up the phone and call us. We'll tell you what's going on. And you see that there's tolerance in the public, in other domains. I often say that. Think about the people that have laser eye surgery. They've got no idea. There's some algorithm controlling the laser cutter. They're handing over their eyes, of which they only have two. And if the thing messes up, it's their eyesight. And yet they trust that algorithm. And you get in your car, and your car is a great big computer, isn't it? And people trust it. And self-driving cars are not resident. And yet there is such hesitation when it comes to quant management. Mind you, I can make a concession because, as I say to you, the amount of randomness in financial markets is very high. That is a problem, right? And it's a problem for us in general because we're all good students, good technical people, committed workers, and sometimes doing a very good job will still get you a tough patch in the markets when you go live with the strategy, which is difficult to live with. But apart from that, people, they like a story. I wish they didn't. I wish they were more rational and more objective about it. But there you go.
We humans are weird animals. My favorite example, the algorithm aversion, was how back in the day people used to have doormen in elevators, because the idea that a human would trust the machine to take them up and down was ridiculous. So they literally had to hire people just to stand there and hit the buttons. So otherwise people can get in. On the narrative side, one thing that was fascinating, obviously after 2008, trend following did incredibly well, attracted a lot of capital as a result, and then started spluttering and then went through a long period where it either went sideways or did badly. Why was that?
One of the things that I can tell you is that trend following is desirable, not because it's a high Sharpe ratio or high performance smooth strategy, but because it has these bursts of negative correlation at desirable times. The first comment to make is that that attribute never changed. So even though, yes, from the financial crisis onwards, there was a tough patch for trend following, that tough patch, every time markets turned a bit difficult, a bit stressed, trend following delivered. The part of trend following that faltered was this ability to deliver some good returns every year, year after year. So this ability to carry positively. It's the insurance policy that I want to own, but I don't want to pay for. I want to pay to be paid to hold that insurance policy. So I want my trend following to come to the rescue when I have problems, but I also wanted to generate a bit of return every year. And this ability to generate a bit of return every year became a bit challenged. What does that mean? Well, that means that monetizing the trend signal has become tougher. And so the first thing to say is, does that mean trend following is broken? Shall I give it up forever? Well, mathematically can't say that because the signal is too weak. And even a period of many years of difficult performance will still not signify that it's broken. It's the challenge of the investor in trend following that you need to size your position, you need to pick your entry time, and then you leave it alone because if you try to time it, you cannot. So the first comment is that the nature of the underperformance was really with respect to the ability to carry positively, and the length of the underperformance wasn't really meaningful mathematically. So couldn't say anything mathematically. Do we give up on trend following? And we kind of thought, look, you can't give up on the thing because it's too good. Investors really want this stuff. And so 12 ideas on the board, 12 things we can try that are completely different. Let's try some. And then 4 came good. So 4 new ways to implement trend following added to the existing one that we had made 5. So some of them using lagged oscillators, some of them using machine learning, some of them using grouping of securities to calculate the trend rather than calculate it on the time series of each security. And so then we developed this approach to trend following that was blended, that was no longer the one best way to generate the signal that we had before, but rather 5 approaches in combination. And we call that the blended approach. And that has been doing a lot better. It's a lot more robust. So answer to your question, yeah, it's become more difficult. Mathematically, I can't prove why. Have we found a remedy? We think we have to an extent. It's not perfect, but it addresses the problems to a large extent. Still, when the trends are clear, and when are the trends clear? Well, they're clear when they are staring you in the macroeconomic face. Inflation, that's a massive trend at the moment. War in Ukraine, that's a massive trend in commodities. When the trends are clear, the old signals are pretty unbeatable. So they kind of catch on and off they go. But when the markets are difficult, range bound, not going anywhere, lots of volatility, this sort of blended approach to evaluate the trend does a lot better. Bit of engineering, bit of research, and we've been managing to improve the process. So good old Blue Trend had award nominations in the last couple of years. It's won some awards, and hopefully that is the result of this innovation, right?
So what do you think the future of, I say quantitative investing, but really maybe just investing overall? Is it essentially a supercomputer sitting there with some machine learning algorithms that just churns along and you can go to the Swiss countryside and practice your Ducati mountain driving?
No, I don't think that is the case. I think that the whole space, the whole industry will become more and more and more quantitative. But the idea, you've got the self-driven car. Can you have the self-investing fund? No, you can't. And the reason is, because if you think about the data that the self-driving algorithm takes. How much randomness is that in that data? You tell a car to drive from here where I am to Heathrow. There are pictures of the road. There's some randomness as to level of light when the picture was taken, or but all that can be corrected for. And you can have truckloads of data. You can have as much visual data as you want. Financial markets are not like that. There's a truckload of randomness. There's stuff that you can't explain. And also the amount of data available is not that large. Think about Netflix has what? 150 million subscribers. So those guys, if they're going to set up a recommender system, the thing that says, because you watch this, you should watch something, they've got loads of data. They don't need to care about what the fit looks like. They know the fit will be stable because there's so much data driving that algorithm. We can't afford to do that because machine learning in the limit, the picture is this. If you roll a die a million times, and you feed the results of your throw to a machine learning algorithm, is that machine learning algorithm going to be any good at predicting the next throw of the die? Not really. It's random. And so it's the same thing here. You have a lot of randomness in financial markets. And so to let machine learning algorithms loose on the data doesn't really work. What you can do is you can narrow the scope. You're not giving the raw data to an algorithm. You're giving pre-treated data with a pre-treated mission, with a very bound scope, but it's a very prescriptive way of saying to the machine, listen, in this little playpen here, off you go. You can tell me what to do, but just here. You can't say to a machine learning algorithm, make me some money. That doesn't work.
You still think that broadly the future is building processes that make money over time, rather than just hiring a bunch of brilliant portfolio managers and traders.
Exactly. And it's a tall order, right? You're not content with making money tomorrow. You want to make money by deploying a process that my pension fund client can be reassured that if I'm not around, if there's succession here and new people will come in, but the intellectual property and the methodology to devise it is solid and will continue.
Yeah, people, process, and technology at the core. Given the way that the asset management industry is evolving, quite a lot of people listening to this podcast are young and some of them students are maybe thinking of getting into this. What should they be doing? Should they be studying engineering, computer science, data science, or should they still look at some of the more traditional avenues into the asset management industry?
I think that studying data science, engineering, mathematics, these are such good grounding skills to have. I remember I was a teenager and had this fantastic maths teacher. We were studying for various math competitions. And I remember his first lesson, he said, what is mathematics? Mathematics is a language. And everybody knows that learning languages is something you should try to do when you're young. You can always learn about financial statements, the idiosyncrasies of running companies, geopolitical tension. These are things you can study later. But if you get a good grounding on the scientific side, on mathematics, on expressing, on treating data, that is a very powerful thing to do. Not to mention computer skills, being autonomous when it comes to doing a bit of data analysis, setting something up, taking a look at it. So I would always encourage people to get those scientific quantitative skills and then specialize those skills in the financial sector. That would be my suggestion.
Well, I guess the days where traders thought Python was a type of snake are probably numbered.
Absolutely.
Well, Leda, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure to chat to you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.